Tomorrow, of course, is the fast of Shavuos and Tammuz, and it behooves us to look forward in preparation and just become a little engaged in what's taking place, what did take place, in order to make the fast more meaningful. But before we even do that and review the historical significance of the day, I'm going to share with you something. It's worth $1 million, maybe $10 million. So good. Forgive me if you hear this as a drush again a couple years upstairs. Don't be surprised. But this is something you probably never heard anywhere before. So if you look in the Mishnah in Tinus, so we're told that there were five critical events that occurred historically on this day. Most notably, Moshe Rabbeinu came down from Har Sinai. He smashed the luchos when he sees Klal Yisrael involved in the Chedah Egel. We have the breaking of the walls of Yerushalayim in anticipation of the ultimate destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. We have a story of Apostolos burning a Sefer Torah, the Korban Talmud was interrupted. It was no longer bought every single day. And finally, there was a point in history when an idol was placed in the Kodesh HaKadosh and the Beis HaMikdash. So those are all terrible, terrible events. Now, what you may not know about Shavuos HaTammuz is the following. There's an individual by the name of Captain Jonathan Gross. He is currently an attorney and a law professor at West Point. He lives in White Plains. He's a firm guy. He did not grow up from his story. How he became more religious is fascinating in its own right. You can find it in Illuminations of the Maggid by Rabbi Krohn. Happy to share with you his background. He had two tours of duty in Iraq in the early 2000s. And the unbelievable Siyata Dishmaya, what he had to go through to keep Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot, and Hanukkah, and the help that miraculously came his way from the Ribono Shel Olam is worth a drush in its own right. But what's not published in that volume is a story that was put out about 5 years ago in one of the Jewish newspapers by Rabbi Fischel Schachter, and I want to share that part of the story with you this evening. So in 2006, going back a little bit before that, December 13, 2003 was when they found Saddam Hussein in a little pit that he dug out for himself. Ultimately the Americans captured him, gave him over to the newly formed Iraqi government. They put him on trial and they executed him. After that point, obviously there was a significant American occupation, and it was a struggle because as much as the Americans try to bring order to Iraq, the absence of even the dictatorship just meant it was hefker. There was terrorist groups and militia fighting each other, and for the regular citizens it was deadly, and there was rampant poverty. So America was involved there in two stages up till 2006. It reached a point where the American effort was stalling. There was pressure on George W. Bush, who ultimately decided in 2007 to begin the surge, which was another wave of troops brought to Iraq. Jonathan Gross was in both of those waves. What happened in the later wave, when they were trying to regain control and bring some semblance of stability there, was they realized that they were competing with the terrorist groups who realized that the people had no money. As long as Saddam Hussein was in power, so he was doing favors and providing food for the people who returned the favor to him. So in its wake, he had the terrorist groups were saying, look, your family has no bread. We'll give you bread if you dig a hole, and we'll give you bread if you fill it with some explosives, and we'll give you bread if you cover up over the pit so that the next time an American convoy drives by, there's an explosion. And as we know, there were terrible casualties on the American side in those years in Iraq. So the American government had an eyeful. They said, instead of trying to fight fire with fire, we're going to fight money with money. The thing that's motivating the loyalty towards the terrorist groups is the fact that they can eat, and they're paying for people to participate in these attacks against the Americans. So we'll give them more money not to dig holes, and that's essentially what happened. And it was remarkably successful for a period of time. And they made sure that wherever compensation was possible, they actually set up these tribunals where American commanders and attorneys would come set up shop in a little village in Iraq. And if people there would claim, there was a bombing and we lost our parnassah, we lost our family, they would sit and they would, hear the case, verify to some degree of accuracy, and pay the family as fast as possible. So ultimately the loyalty came in many of these outlying regions in the direction of the Americans. Jonathan Gross was on one of these teams, as an attorney in the 101st Airborne Division. Before he would, you know, hear the cases that were brought before him, he would learn a little bit about the surroundings. He would look on the map and become familiar with the localities, because that just being informed would allow him to assess the validity of the claims that came before him. So he came to a certain village in the Euphrates River Valley, and the general vicinity was known as Mahmudia. Okay, and there was one particular neighborhood in Mahmudia that on the map, it was labeled as Tammuz 17. It's a name. You can probably Google it on Google Maps. There's a village in Iraq in the Euphrates Valley known as Tammuz 17. So he started asking around some of the other officers there, you know, where did that name come from? Again, he was from at that time, I think, and, you know, it definitely stuck out at him. And no one had any information. So finally, he sat down with one of the tribal leaders there, a sheikh, and he asked him, what is this name, Tammuz 17? I'm reading to you from the article. This is what the sheikh responded to him. The day of 17 Tammuz is a glorious day in our calendar. It's an Iraqi speaking. In this day, we conquered our enemies. Saddam built the neighborhood because he said we would conquer our enemies again, and he wanted us to have a place to celebrate that when it happened. 20 years ago. Now, you have to understand, Saddam Hussein believed that he was a Gilgal of Nebuchadnezzar. Ad kedei kach, that they found in the palace that, you know, they took over these palaces. He was building palaces all over the country. He built a palace that was ultimately taken over, and the Americans turned it into the embassy. And they found on one of the ceilings a portrait, a giant painting of Nebuchadnezzar with Saddam Hussein's face on it. Crazy. He was a madman. He was a mamash madman. And so he felt that his calling in life was to, you know, just like Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, he was going to lay siege to Yerushalayim. He spoke often of besieging Yerushalayim as his ancestor had done. He was fascinated with the date 17 Tammuz, which apparently in his tradition was a day the city's defenses were breached. And that's when we mark the same event. Apparently, many of the Scud missiles that were fired on Eretz Yisrael had the words 17 Tammuz written on the side of the missiles. Mind blowing. This was the Iraqi dictator, besides building a nuclear power plant, countless palaces, and oppressing his people, also set aside time, money, and energy to start building a city called 17 of Tammuz. His diabolical intention was to celebrate his invasion of Yerushalayim there, Hashem Yirachem. And all of that, right, went up in smoke. None of that happened, and no one would even know about it if not for the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put one Jew randomly in that outlying village in the middle of nowhere in Iraq to tell the story to us. You know, we're just coming off of Parshas Balak. Balak the whole story is, you may be so used to the story, but perhaps you never considered is, there's no indication in the entire Parsha that a single Jew knew what was happening from start to finish. Bilam and Balak are up on some top of, you know, a cliff, a mountain, looking at Klal Yisrael, and there's no Jewish interaction in the Parsha. And it's not clear that the Jews ever find out about it until much later, until it's recorded in the Torah, maybe in Parshas Kisetze, that, you know, there's a little bit of a hint to it. But it, as it's happening, no idea whatsoever. Who knows what we were saved from, right? This is just a tiny inkling. Saddam Hussein's plot, for all the things we do know about, he had this whole system built around a piece of history that we're all familiar with, and that was driving his entire crusade against Eretz Yisrael. And yet, for the last 20 years, who knew about this? Who knew about this? And it should be a simon to us that of all the chassadim, we're thankful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, all the times that he has saved Klal Yisrael, how many more thousands of times did he save us from enemies that we didn't even know about it? And this is an example where we found out about it later. It's important because even in Tisha B'Av itself, right, there's a switch. One side of the corner of Avelis turns immediately into Shabbos Nachamu. Even as we're marking Tisha B'Av, we don't say Tachanun. Because it's a little bit, it's a moed. We call it a moed, right? There's a hopeful ambition and yearning that Chazal, Halacha, Kodesh Baruch Hu put even into the tragic times in our history that we can look forward, that Mashiach is born on Tisha B'Av. And even in the marking of Shavuos B'Tammuz, such a tragic day, we have a little shining light in this story of that hopefulness. Kodesh Baruch Hu says, I'm saving you from things you didn't even know about. You only have an inkling of the dangers. About 20 years ago, I was sitting in YU as a student, and this was in the midst of the Second Intifada. We were getting reports every single day there was another bus bombing. Every single day. And every shul in the world was saying Tehillim after davening, one, two, three chapters of Tehillim. Friday night, we were sitting around, and Rosh Hashanah walked in, and in the midst of the conversation, one of the Talmidim said, you know, Rebbe, I don't understand. We say Tehillim every single day. It's so disheartening. Nothing has stopped. There's still people dying. There's still so much terrorism. Like, you know, how do we face that? And without batting an eyelash, he said, you have no idea how much worse it could be if you weren't davening. You have no idea. What? We should belittle the chassadim we're enjoying. Of course, we want more chassadim. We got to daven harder. We're not there yet. But how do you know how much Hashem is saving us from? How do you know? That was a game changer for me in my entire life. The message, 1 minute left, is that tomorrow, it's a long fast day. And most of us by 9 o'clock, by 8 o'clock, by 7 o'clock, long before that, we're looking at our watch. It's a hot day. It's a hard day. And davening's longer. But take a few minutes. At least if you daven at the 8 o'clock minute and 9 o'clock minute, where are we rushing? If you're not going to work, where are we rushing to? If Slichas takes a few minutes longer and we read some of the English and we know what we're saying, if we say Hashem, Hashem, kel rachum v'chanun, we're screaming, yod gimel midos for rachamim, with a little more energy and focus. And when you hear the words at mincha, we're experiencing right now, Ra al amecha. Please, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, hinachem al, change your mind from that. Bring us that nechama. With 2-3 minutes longer, slightly slower Shemona Esri, that's all HaKadosh Baruch Hu asks from us. And that's why we have days like tomorrow on our calendar.